You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
That music can only mean one thing. That means it is, in fact, 5 minutes past one on a very, well, gloomy Saturday afternoon here in Melbourne. Welcome to Cravings. My name is Pete Dillon, and we are here for another episode of what is all good in Melbourne, food and wine. And, of course, we'll look across the country with one of my other guests today. It is the final week of MasterChef, and we're down to a couple of contestants. There are just two of them. It's going to be an interesting night on Sunday night. I assume there'll be squillions and millions of people tuning in to watch yet another MasterChef final with Callum and Adam. I don't know who to go for yet, but we'll come to that. Joining me today a little later in the program is the pastry chef who is the... I'm going to call him the Terminator because there's pretty much nobody can match what this man does. And we're also going to spend pretty much most of the hour with a fabulous fellow whose name is Richard Cornish. You may have read his name. You may know his name. But he joins me today, and we're going to talk about Movida, Movida Rustica, Movida Acqui, and a whole bunch of other projects that Richard has going on. So stick with me for the next hour. Pop the cork out of something, whether it's a bottle of gin, a bottle of wine, or a bottle of diet fizzy. And don't forget, 0427 Joy949 is the number, 1300 Joy949 if you want to call in, on air at joy.org.au if you want to email in, or of course you can tweet to cravings_JOY949. Sit back, relax, we've got an hour of fabulous food coming. To start the program, I did mention that Richard Cornish is going to join me. Good afternoon, Richard. Welcome to Cravings.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for inviting me in.
It's a joy to have you here. Now, listen, we're going to just run through some foodie news. You can pop in at any time if you have anything to say about
any of
this.
I've got some gossip. Pictures as well.
You've got which?
Pictures of people as well.
Good. Oh, I like dirty gossip. Lock Thornton and Annie Smithers have ended their partnership after only 4 months, with industry identities blaming irreconcilable differences. It sounds like a divorce to me. Smithers says the split that took place 2 weeks ago, it was like one of those things that you go into with the best of intentions, but the chemistry just wasn't there. Lock's a very clever ideas man, but the partnership didn't have the sparkle I was hoping for. Annie Smithers' bistro in Kyneton will continue as normal, she says, with the recent addition of Daniel Saligari, who's from Ciccone's. Thornton, the former Royal Mail Hotel sommelier, will be spending more time governing the wine side of the business at Steve Boyle's recently launched Pandora's Box. Gary Meehan, that very fabulous MasterChef judge, former Temple of Molecular Gastronomy Phoenix, more recently a functions venue, reopened last week, several years after the ugly dissolution of the now MasterChef judge's partnership with Raymond Capaldi. Of course, Capaldi, as we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, has confirmed that Locarno 150 at the Old Mercy Building in Clarendon Street is not going ahead. What's he doing, Richard, do you know?
I've got some good gossip on Raymond Capaldi.
What? Go on.
Have you seen the BBC comedy In the Loop?
Yeah.
There's an actor there called Peter Capaldi, a Scotsman, who swears like a trooper.
As does Raymond, who's a Scotsman.
And it's his cousin.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Peter Capaldi is Raymond Capaldi's cousin.
Well, there you go.
Same cheekbones and same foul mouth. I spoke to him the other day about it.
Ah.
Yeah, he said, oh, this is my brother, eh? No, this is my cousin. This is my cousin.
So what's he... Do you know what he's going to be doing next? I know he's looking at...
Tight-lipped. Tight-lipped.
Okay.
Tight-lipped, but I think it's not far off.
Okay.
And what he's going to do is going to be very, very exciting. He's a very, very clever chef.
Oh, he is. He's extraordinary.
He's a very clever chef. I think he came into molecular gastronomy too early for Melbourne.
Mm.
I think he was a little bit ahead of the pack, but what he does is great. And some of the... molecular gastronomy can be something very simple.
Mm. And now that we've caught up with it, I'm sure that...
he's going to spread his wings and fly. He's a
my
very
word,
good chef.
My word, he will. He's an extraordinary chef. And I have to keep referring to a dinner that I did with Rene Redzepi and Raymond Capaldi.
Oh,
extraordinary.
Upstairs at the...
Level 89, Eureka.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Probably the best meal I've ever eaten, but we'll come back to that. The reinvented Phoenix on the bank of the Yarra in Richmond will aim slightly northwards of its rumoured neo-cafe status and feature a menu heavily accented towards Meehan's English background and French training. Head chef will be Martin Horsley, who recently left Joseph's at the Werribee Park Mansion. In good news for Victoria, last week Holly Goat was named the best agricultural producer for 2010 by the Royal Agricultural Society of New South Wales. They pocketed $10,000 and the RAS President's Medal, which is terrific for Holly Goat. They make a fabulous little series of goat's cheeses and all sorts of things. Meredith.
Sutton Grange near Bendigo.
Sorry, beg your pardon.
Two of the best, perhaps the best cheese producers in Australia. And Amory and Carla are not going to pocket the money. They are going to build their own little cave, their own little cellaring cave, to do really special cheeses, perhaps for their own personal consumption, which might not be pasteurized, but they'll be for their own consumption, just so they can understand what they're doing.
Mm. I was alerted to a tweet earlier in the week from Dan Sims, who is from Somers Australia, the wine guy, very good mate of this program and my own, and he said that he ate some raw sheep's milk cheese and he's not dead yet.
Yeah, well, we had some raw goat's milk cheese about 2 years ago with Mary Ellis from the barn in Dalesford, and she had an illegal dinner. Everything on the table is illegal. Raw milk cheese, beef that had been dry aged for 4 months, I think it was, birds that were wild shot. The goat's milk cheese that arrived on the table was probably one of the best cheeses I've eaten globally.
And you've
luckily made.
You've consumed the odd piece of cheese.
Oh, yeah. The fact that I refer to myself as Richard since Fat Albert Cornish would indicate that I'm not a small person. And I'm not dead.
And I'm not small either, which is a shame. The partnership, another split behind North Melbourne's meat-centric Bistro Brisk has split. Chef Michael Slade has left to pursue other interests, leaving behind Dean Bocchia, who was handling the front-of-house side of the one-year-old business. Slade was previously head chef with Adrian Richardson at La Luna, another very good friend of this program, and says Brisk was heading in the direction he wasn't comfortable with. Bocchia, a trained chef, has headed back to the kitchen to oversee a change of identity that will see the soon-to-be-renamed Victoria Street restaurant concentrate on a more casual neighbourhood vibe with a focus on pizza. I don't know that North Melbourne needs more pizza, but I guess there's never enough. City Joint Journal Canteen's experiment in opening for dinner on Friday nights has been so successful that starting this very week, owner Rosa Mitchell will be opening on Thursdays as well. She says it gives her a chance to get out on the floor and chat to people because it's slightly less frenetic.
Best thing about Rosa's Canteen, you can go there, get a $25 three-course set menu and a cuddle.
Oh, she's adorable.
Ah, yes. I call it, she is about, for those who don't know Rosa, the canteen, the general canteen is inside the Council of Adult Education. And go upstairs. You can't see Rosa because she's hidden behind the bench. She is so short. She's only about 3 foot high.
She's slightly taller than 3 foot Richard Cornish.
No, she's a very dear friend of mine.
Now, another split. There seems to be splits happening all over Melbourne at the minute, and Glamorpus Left Bank, which is owned by Emirates Leisure, has made a personnel change early in the restaurant's life. Exec chef James Tan has left barely 7 months into his tenure, and the restaurant has said that two chefs are already on deck to fill the void. What's going on in this town, Richard Cornish?
A lot of movement. It's always good to see. It means we've got a really healthy eating environment. When people are stuck in their ways, you just don't have that tension. And there's creative tension. There are chefs moving across, like the new Chapel Street eatery that Locke Thornton's moved to, which is called
Pandora's
Box.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of staff moving to there at present. Because it's just an attractive move. People get tired of working the same places. People get tired of working under the same fluorescent lights, the same crew, being yelled at in the same way. They want to move to another place with fluorescent lights and be yelled at in a different way.
Exactly. I'm joined by Richard Cornish, who's pretty much the man that has his finger in, or on, the pulse.
Finger in the pulse and hands on pies. What? What's going on here?
In Melbourne, he knows pretty much everything. We will be joined shortly on the phone by a very special guest who can talk a little bit of MasterChef with us. You're not a MasterChef fan, are you?
I know who the winner is.
So do I think.
I know who it is.
How do you know who it is? It's a finale that's not on till Sunday night, apparently being taped live.
No,
allegedly, purportedly.
No, Channel 10.
Okay, good.
They are making so much
money. They're making Mozza.
And Fremantle Productions.
Yeah, Fremantle Media, isn't it?
Yep, they're making a lot of money out of it.
$75,000 in advertisement. It's extraordinary.
There's a lot of money. It's creating so much excitement around a certain level of food. For me, it's a reality television.
Well, of course, that's always what it's been. But
never watched Big Brother. Haven't watched MasterChef.
More news. Nick Zampelli's waterfront restaurant is being resurrected in nearby digs at Southgate in a move that will provide direct competition for Atlantic. The 300-seat seafood restaurant connected to the Clams Group and headed by the another crazy chef, Donovan Cook.
Oh, fantastic.
Formerly of the Hong Kong Jockey Club.
Oh, okay. Well, that's great news.
Atlantic's lure led Crown to Ice Zampelli's waterfront and Cafe Greco, which enjoyed prime river frontages. The Never Say Die Zampelli's will be popping up on the ground floor promenade site vacated last week by the 18-year-old Augusto, and neighbouring Bistro Vite, who will be leaving in September after a major overhaul. There's someone throwing a lot of money around at Crown at the minute. Expect another massive 300-seat seafood restaurant to open early in December.
Wow, that's huge.
There's always something happening at Crown. Always.
You need excitement.
You do.
You need change.
Now, in more Produce Awards, the 2010 Produce Awards by Delicious magazine saw South Australia's Coffin Bay pristine oysters run by Tony Brendan and Nick Guidera was named Producer of the Year and winner of the From the Sea category. Good night for South Australia. The Australian Caper Company, which is based at Manham, won the category From the Earth. The regional award went to McLaren Vale for outstanding use of regional produce by a chef, and the winner was, of course, David Swain of Fino Restaurant in Wollonga. Victorian winners included Wagyu specialist David Blackmore and Holly Goat from the dairy, and I'm from the paddock, of course. Also from Victoria, cheesemaker Richard Thomas was recognised for his outstanding contribution to Australian food, while the Collingwood Children's Farmers Market was recognised as Australia's finest. There were some awards for New South Wales and Queensland, but we probably don't care about those. So good news for some Victorians there. And Brussels' Nick Pollart, who is an interesting young chef, he's sticking to his guns and he's offering horse meat at next month's Taste of Melbourne and on his regular restaurant menu after his supplier, Perth butcher Vincent Garefa, received death threats from animal liberationists. This has been a huge story in the last couple of weeks, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts on the consumption, Richard, of horse meat.
We eat meat. What's the difference between a cow and a horse or a sheep or a pig? You are taking a sentient animal's life. They know they're going to die. It's not a pretty sight if anyone's killed an animal. What's the difference?
Well, there is no difference. I think one of the interesting things for me is Hilary McNevin, who you know quite well, I believe.
Oh, Hilary. Love Hilary.
Hilary's a great mate of this program. She's been a presenter. She was on only a couple of weeks ago with me. We're having a discussion about horse meat. Now, there was a number of years ago, probably about 5 or 6 years ago, the feral camel situation in the Northern Territory and Northern South Australia created an industry for the capture of the camels and the production of meat, which has both been exported and used in a very smaller way here with things like camel prosciutto and stuff, all which you can buy quite freely now. And there was the same outcry, the same uproar. These horses are all feral, running around Western Australia. They're creating extraordinary amount of issue for agriculturalists in a variety of means, and therefore I believe it's actually it's sensible to be able to capture them and then use them.
When we anthropomorphize animals and give them human-like attributes, we then start working out what are the nice animals and what are the not nice animals. It's okay to kill a pig, but not a cat. It's okay to kill a cow, but not a dog. It's okay to kill a tuna, but not a dolphin.
Yeah.
And we've divided up the animals into all these nice and not...
The ones we like and the ones we don't.
The fluffy animals and the ones we like to eat. And I think that's... really, really dodgy ground to base arguments on. Either you don't eat animals or you do.
Exactly.
And I prefer to eat less animal product, more vegetable product, and the animals that are eaten need to be treated in a humane way, have a dignified slaughter, and one where they're not tortured. And having done this very recently, taking an animal's life to make produce, I do know that to do it respectfully, a human does have to have remorse, and it actually takes a toll on humans to take an animal's life.
Of course.
And so, less animal meat, more vegetables, and treat them well.
But yet, there's people who will say, oh, I don't eat meat, but they'll eat eggs, and those eggs are 9 times out of 10 probably from a battery hen.
An animal living a tortured life.
Exactly. Yeah. Who's being just fed. To produce eggs, I don't know.
I think it's not black or white. There's a whole range of arguments along that logic of animal treatment, and where you stand, you really have to think it through. I think taking animal meat for granted is probably a bigger problem than taking an animal's life, because if you're eating a whole lot of rubbish meat from an animal that hasn't been treated well, that has suffered a dreadful death, that hasn't been cooked properly, you're not respecting the animal, you're not respecting the environment, you're not respecting yourself.
Oh, exactly. Thank you to those people who've sent text messages. I won't read them out because one or two of them could be a little abusive, but it's not a discussion that I really want to get into with our listeners. So thank you for your texts. I won't read them. Back to Nicolas Pollard. The Frenchman says he hasn't received any threats himself, although he was aware of heated comments on blogs. He says, I grew up in the north of France and horse meat's very common there. For how long it'll be on the menu, I don't know. If it's working, it's working. Griffa had to receive government permission to supply the meat in his shop, although Australia already exports horse meat for human consumption. Podart is offering a three-course horse tasting menu next Tuesday, so those of you that are brave enough may want to pop into Embrasse and check it out. I've eaten it.
Yeah.
In Japan. Yeah. It's quite common to eat horse in Japan.
Yeah.
I can't say it was my favourite. You know, it was sliced very raw, like a carpaccio.
Mm-hmm. You enjoyed it?
No. My palate was very young back then as well. I was only in my very early 20s. So I think if I was to sit down and have that same dish again, I may enjoy it a great deal more.
I just have this vision of Nicholas Pollard being chastised by a whole lot of jockeys in silks with their crops outside his restaurant. He goes to serve the horse meat.
Oh, and they're so scary jockeys, aren't they?
Mr. Driscoll.
Sorry.
The voice you can hear is that of Richard Cornish. He is joining me for the remainder of the program. One more little piece of news. Who is the Australian who has most influenced you regarding food and eating? I'm going to come back to this question for you because the People's Choice Award, first launched in 2008 as part of the Australian Food Media Awards, is asking this open question with no prompting. Television cook Maggie Beer won last time, but nominations are not restricted to celebrities. It can be your mum, your dad, an individual, a restaurant, an historic chef, a relative, a friend, a neighbour. The aim is to mirror today's society, reflecting by name where the greatest food influences lie. Voting closes on July 31, and you can go to foodprofessionals.org.au/AFMA2010-people's-choice-award. If you just go to foodprofessionals.org.au, AFMA, you will in fact see that there are opportunities to vote. And this very program will be nominated this year for Best Radio, so there you go.
I hope you do very well in that. I think, speak to any food professional, and you will find that there is one pivotal person in their life, one moment, and generally around a person that will have changed the way they see the world.
Mm.
And I think a lot of your listeners will have that, a lot of the people who are really into food will have that one moment in their life that changed the way they see things.
Mm. Who was yours?
For me, it would have been, taking food with respect, it would have been Giridara.
Mm.
At Stephanie's. I was working at Channel 9. I think I was the mail boy then. And I was taking around the mail to people like Daryl Summers and Tony Barber in those days.
Oh, God. Those were the days of Sale of the Century and hey, it's Saturday on Saturday morning.
And I had my first paycheck and I took my mum out. Mum was a widow and took her out for a meal. And Giridara sat us down. And for the first time in my life, I've been treated with respect as a diner. She was going to take my money, yes, but she just looked at us as she would anyone else and said, what do we order? And she said, order the first thing that comes into your head.
Mm.
And such a mellifluous way that we just melted into our chairs and every apprehension about being in a slightly stiff place.
Mm.
We just melted into our chairs. We had the most wonderful evening. And she taught me so much that night about respect for yourself, respect for your palate, and respect for your food. It was just like, enjoy. It's okay.
And for those that don't know Duray, she was in fact Stephanie's right-hand woman on the floor at Stephanie's. She then opened EQ with a number of interests. She moved out of EQ. She has a noodle bar in Burke Street, and she's just sort of sold out of another business so she can concentrate on noodle.
A noodle, and the other one was called Replenishment, no, Reservation, no.
No, something like that.
Yourself, what about you? What was your moment?
Look, I have to come back to Stephanie's as well. When I was an apprentice chef, I was a very naive little sort of wide-eyed kid from the country doing my apprenticeship in the bush, and I badgered Stephanie Alexander to give me some work experience. She very kindly did, and when I had her in here on the program, she was highly apologetic that she only gave me a week. But I think walking into that kitchen and doing that work experience with Stephanie, who was, at that time, this is sort of, you know, mid-80s, mm-hmm. Where her, Mieta, Tony Rogelsky, Richard Frank, Ian mm-hmm. Hewitson had memories at the Mediterranean,
mm-hmm.
you know, all of those people. It was just a phenomenal experience, and I think something that I took with me for the rest of my very short cooking journey. Now, my next guest is waiting for me on the phone. He is, in fact, in Brisbane doing masterclasses this weekend. And, look, I'm the Terminator is what I want to call him. He is somebody who you will be familiar with if you've clapped your eyes on the box over the last two seasons, this season and, of course, the last of MasterChef. He is the man who has bought us Croquembouche and Macaron Towers and a layered chocolate cake and now something dubbed the V8. He joins me now, Adriano Zumbo. Welcome to Cravings.
How you going, Pete? Mate, I'm very well. I've got Richard Cornish here with me as well, so if you hear another voice, it shall be that of him.
Okay, no worries.
So how does a boy from Canamble become this man that destroys dreams?
I grew up in a supermarket and I guess, you know, was a fussy eater, lived off lollies, you know, filled my school bag with lemmingtons, cakes, biscuits, and so forth, and then I'd eat it all through class, and I guess, you know, you'd sit there with your mates and sort of, you know, just indulge in the back of the classroom rather than, I guess, well, I did that rather than in some classes where I wasn't good at learning.
So how's your geography and your social study skills?
Actually, geography was good. Actually, that's one class I didn't eat lollies in was geography. Geography, woodwork, PE, what else? Sometimes maths, I wouldn't really do much, but like English, science, and commerce and all that, I'd be eating lollies.
So let's go back to this life of yours before you were brought to Australia's attention in MasterChef last year with the Crock and Bush.
Yep.
You grew up in country New South Wales in Canamble.
Yep.
Your parents had a supermarket, so that's where all these lollies and sweets were coming from.
Yep.
What is it with pastry that sort of grabbed you at a young age? What was the thing about pastry that made you want to pursue a career creating some extraordinary things that you produce?
I think it's, you know, it's the colour, the range of flavours and textures, you know, that you eat in a candy bar or in a cake. I guess it was that sort of fantasy land.
Mm.
You know, where, you know, you got Willy Wonka and so forth, and it was, I don't know, as I got older, I guess, you know, I didn't think I could go to uni, I didn't think I could go to, because I didn't really have an interest to go there, not because, you know, I couldn't go there, it's just I didn't have an interest, you know, and I knew I wouldn't do something like that, so I knew I was always going to do something creative, something with my hands, so, like, I started making packet cake mixes, and, you know, the people at school loved it, so it was that, and then that from that I got a good reward, you know, from the people who ate the cake.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't nothing flash, but you know, I grew up country town, you know, never heaps of things of flash out there anyway. So
yeah.
it was that, I don't know, that feeling you get when someone tells you something, you know, making people happy.
Mm.
It's one of the most priceless things of this job, you know, is that reward, that sense of pleasing someone. And making their day happy, so...
Which I guess is the motivation for a lot of chefs. You've got a very natural curiosity, and the world around you influences your creations. Let's talk about MasterChef for a little bit, because it is finals week. We're down to two, we're down to Adam and Callum to take out the title tomorrow night. How much has being a part of MasterChef had an influence on your career, your business?
Yeah, look, it's had a massive influence. Look, I started my business 3 years ago, you know, before MasterChef ever aired and all that, and I was doing well and the business was growing quite rapidly, and then I got the call up to get a chance to go on, you know, kind of by accident.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, ever since that day, it's been pretty insane, but... It's done a great thing for me, you know, in a way of, you know, things were heading up and it sort of just smacked in the face.
Mm.
And it really, I guess it puts you on a national scale, you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure, because your patisserie is in Balmain, in the inner suburbs of Sydney, and obviously the locals are going to be slightly miffed that you're all of a sudden ridiculously famous.
Oh, yeah, I wish I could fix that, you know what I mean? It's hard because, you know, before it was the locals and everyone there, and they, you know, it was quite easy to get in, and now you've got to queue up to get in, even if you just want a loaf of bread.
Yeah, look, I'm expecting an express delivery in the post of some macaroons, because my housemate and I, since watching you watch the guys create the macaroon tower on MasterChef, which was your first input this year, I'm pretty much craving macarons ever since, and because I've been on a diet, I haven't been able to eat them, so sadly I live in Melbourne and can't pop to Balmain and get myself a dozen or so. Now, I talked before about you're inspired by the world around you, the creativity. There's some interesting desserts that tell a story of particular personalities. Lucas rides the tube. Tell us. Go on. Tell us.
Hey, Lucas writes a tune.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a mix, though. It's, I guess it's about a guy who works for me, and he's quite bubbly, and he's quite, you know, he's out there. And I guess it was always a mystery for me, you know, what, you know, like sort of what way, you know, he sort of is, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So what does a dessert consist of, Lucas Rides the Tube?
It's a caramelised macadamia mousse.
Yeah.
With macadamia daiquiris.
Yeah.
And has a pear caramel apple palette, a pear caramel apple, pear caramel palette on top.
Yeah.
And then it has a vanilla creme chantilly, like tube, on the top.
Yeah. Sorry, Richard Cornish is sitting here in the studio with me and he's salivating as much as I am, and I'm not even a dessert eater.
Yeah. Adriano, Richard Cornish, food writer in Melbourne. There's something about patisserie and pastry chefs and pastries they make and the desserts. You have a whole different language. I work in the food industry and you are using terms that I don't use on a day-to-day basis, but you do. Chantilly.
Yeah, chantilly. Chantilly is pretty much just cream with 10% sugar.
Yeah. And you use the word galette.
Pardon?
Did you use the word galette? I couldn't hear you over the phone.
Yeah, palette. I use a palette. I mean, galette is another word in pastry anyway. So.
What is it about pastry that there's all these arcane terms that we don't use, that we mere mortals don't?
I guess French is the gastronomic language of the world, yeah?
Yeah,
yeah, it is.
It sort of all, you know, comes from that sort of history, so.
But it's not so, and pastry...
Sorry.
No, I'm just saying cooking with pastry and making cakes is probably one of the most difficult parts of cookery in the globe. Anyone can make an estofado or a stew, and you might stuff up a few bits and pieces, but in the end you're cooking it for so long, it'll be alright in the end. But stuff up one piece of making bread, you add salty yeast to kill it.
Oh yeah, you know, the way it rides, you know, overprove it and deflate, you know, it's so touch and go with pastry, you know, you really got to hit the mark, otherwise it's not going to turn out right.
I guess that brings us back to the V8. We saw the demise of Elvin Kwar, and what I think after 4 hours of excruciating pain for all five or six of those contestants, that was extraordinary. And I reckon I was sitting in my house and I thought, if I had 8 hours to do that, I would still probably cock it up monumentally. What challenges, if you get invited back next year, what challenges are you going to be able to create that are any more difficult than an 8-layered vanilla creation? I mean, it was extraordinary.
I don't know, eh? I'm not too sure. It'll happen, over the next year or so, I'll create more things and more, you know, and as my, I don't know, wherever my mind takes me and my thoughts, I guess. And as I develop as a pastry chef, you know, I study more about new products and stuff, so I don't know where I'll go.
Righto.
And at that time, when if the show does come back on, I get the call up again, you know, it's, I couldn't answer that. I don't know where I'll be.
Well, after two challenges last year, being the croquembouche, which was the undoing of many, and also that chocolate-layered cake, and then this year the Macaron Tower and the V8, the 8-layered vanilla cake. I think finding anything more difficult is going to be extraordinary. Mate, I wonder if you can stick with us and perhaps find just a slightly quieter corner, because I'm missing bits of you just with noise.
Yeah, no worries.
So just stick with me and we'll hear some noise and we'll come back to you in just a second. Adriano, welcome back. Have we got a bit of a quieter spot?
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, man, you sounded like you're in a train station or something.
I'm in a kitchen.
Excellent. So what's the masterclass in Brisbane all about that you're doing at the minute?
It's a weekend. I've got a demo on tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
It's booked out, 160 people.
So
they're doing a bit of recreation of chicken schnitzel on potato marshmallow.
Potato marshmallow.
Yeah, but it's not chicken. I'm to make it look like chicken schnitzel, but it's sweet.
So what's going to be in place of chicken?
It's coconut, apple, and a bit of roast garlic.
Man, this is... Sorry. I'm finding this extraordinary. Simon Thompson has, I think he said that you're Australia's most effective Croquembouche salesman.
Yeah.
Are you going to become a salesperson for Avant Garde Sweet Food?
I don't know. I guess I like to. I guess it's a bit boring, like doing the average vanilla mousse for me. So, but I like to give a story behind it, you know, every time. So I guess for me this is a memory of me as a kid sitting at lawn bowls watching my dad play lawn bowls.
Mm-hmm.
And I eat chicken schnitzel on mash.
So that's where it all comes from.
I think like that, and I think, how can I make that sweet? You know, and I can actually keep the mash because I can actually some potato sweet because it's quite a neutral flavour.
So, if there was one person that you could say has influenced your career, is it your parents? Is it a chef that you've worked with?
Childhood. In my creations, in my childhood, I guess in my industry, it'd be people like Ramon Marato and Kevin May.
Mm-hmm.
Margaret Fulton, you know?
Yep. Isn't she a doll?
Yeah, she is, and she's just, to do talk to her, she's inspiration. Just, what she's done for the industry and stuff over the years, so...
Mate, I am starting to lose you, so I'll probably let you go. But look, thank you so much for joining us on Cravings. Obviously, people can see more of you at your patisserie in Balmain. Your website is...
www.adrianazumbo.com.
Beautiful. Mate, thank you for joining us on Cravings, and thank you for your influence in what has been a very interesting season of MasterChef 2010.
Thank you very much.
Right, cheers, mate.
Yeah.
That was Adriano Zumbo, who you may recognise from MasterChef. If you're somebody who watches it, Richard, you don't watch MasterChef, do you?
No, but I like the fact that Adriano is now perhaps our most influential pastry cook in Australia.
Mm.
And we've come such a long way that there's no more effetness around pastry chefs. You asked him a question, he went, I don't know, eh? This is the person who can have a career path from the bush into a big city and be making some of the most incredibly difficult and sculptural, beautiful, aesthetically minded desserts, and coming from a place of pure fantasy. But at the same time, that's who he is. That's where he comes from.
A boy from the bush, from Canaville.
Yeah, and this is what we're seeing more and more. Just people just coming up through the ranks. They're not leaving where they came from. They're keeping their roots, and they're bringing where they came from. Could it be an immigrant background? It could be from inner city. It could even be a middle-class white aesthetic. But they're bringing through. They're not being afraid of that. They're just bringing that into their cooking environment and going, this is what I do. Eat it, and it's really good.
Well, it's a little like Ben Shuri, who's we can't call him an immigrant. He's from New Zealand.
You can call him an immigrant.
I call him a lot of things. But he's a man who takes those experiences from his childhood, and he has and I've talked about this a lot on the program, a seafood dish that is filled with grasses that he forages for along the ocean, and it's a clear broth, and it's just extraordinary to taste. But that was an experience or a dish that he created from an experience of a child where he almost drowned off the coast of New Zealand in this little town. And he said he was sort of in this swirling vortex of salt water and seaweed and stuff. And it stuck with him, and he's created this dish.
Yeah, it's like a Richard Flanagan novel.
Oh, it is, yes. Now, let's talk more about you, Richard Cornish. We've spoken about everybody else. We've spoken about...
Thank goodness you get round to it. You've been fluffing around here.
I know, it's terrible. Minutes. You've had a career in Melbourne that's gone for, good Lord, how many years?
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
A few years.
Let's not get personal.
No, let's not. Now, you were the co-author with Frank Camora of Movida in 2007, Movida Rustica in 2009, and currently working on Movida Aqui e Ora.
Yeah, Movida, yep, here and now, Aqui e Ora, it's a snapshot of the Movida group, all the chefs. I'm working with Frank and his chefs, and I've just last week and continuing next week we've been testing recipes from the group and the chefs, and I'm just helping them be the conduit to take a snapshot. It's all their work, and I'm just there just basically writing it down and
bringing it all together because they're very easy books to cook from.
That's what we intend. If you write a book you've got three participants in that project. You've got the author, the publisher, and the reader, and each one needs to get something out of it.
Yeah.
And
one of the publishers is to make money.
The author will be fame and hopefully be able to pay off some small portion of the car.
Debt.
Yes. But also the reader as well. And everyone benefits if the reader's happy. And so it is really important to triple test every single recipe, making sure that you are talking to the reader from their point of view, thinking about the way they're thinking, what they're seeing, why, how they're moving even. The other day we had to roll up a mixture. It was a potato crisp mixture made with steamed potatoes and gelatin and corn flour. We had to roll it in cling film. And I had to practice that movement several times to get the words for it. And to do so, I got a piece of Chuck's Super Wipe and wrapped it in cling film and glad wrap, and then rolled it backwards and forwards so I could actually have the movement to write about in my hand, so that way I could then transfer that across to words. So that is an important part of the process, is actually nailing it for the reader.
So how did you come to co-authoring books for probably one of the most important restaurant groups in Melbourne? I mean, obviously you're a former director of the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival.
Yes.
Obviously, there's a fairly long history that would have brought you to that experience for 2010.
I've been writing for the Age Epicure for 7 years. Before that, I was writing for the food section of the Herald Sun and Divine Food and Wine magazine, the erstwhile Food and Wine magazine, Divine, Gourmet Traveller. From all that experience, from those years of experience and hard work, it came down to sheer nepotism. Because
are you giving me advice here?
No, it's just my best mate, David McIntosh. He is one of the co-owners of Movida, and he said, "We're going to do a book. Let's do it." And I said, "Okay, let's do it."
But you've got to have a pedigree. You can't just be Joe Schmo who's done a bit of writing for here and there, and all of a sudden be the co-author of a book. There's got to be a pedigree, and this has been your life.
Yeah, that's it. I was born on a farm. And can still remember the taste of the corn that I grew.
And the milk from the cows.
The milk from the cows and the way the cows actually smelt.
North.
Yeah, no, just all those things, just those things coming together. And moving to the city, missed all those, and so there was a hint of nostalgia, a way of getting back to those places mentally. And moving, I was working as a television producer, making game shows and documentaries for the Nine Network, and I decided, no, I can make money a little bit easier.
Giggle in the Park gig, is it? Producing game shows?
No, it was quite successful, you know, earning a fair bit of money, but I wanted something where I didn't have to work such long hours.
Mm. You were going to say, work with asshole presenters, weren't you?
I've never worked with an asshole presenter. I'll take that back again. Now, I worked with some really good people. I was very lucky to work with some fantastic people.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the people you tend to remember. They're the people you have the good times with. Started writing, went from writing documentaries to writing food. And found myself here now in studio talking to you, because this is what I do for a living now. Look, sometimes you just find, you know, a lot of your listeners will have pretty amazing jobs. And sometimes some of your listeners might have shit jobs as well. But sometimes you just find yourself in life in a position where you go, oh, my God, this is what I do now. This is what I do for a living. This is my life. Sitting in a Spanish farmhouse in Extremadura, which is on near the Portuguese border north of Seville, and it was a cold day. There was snow outside. You could see the donkey milk from the kitchen door.
Mm.
All of a sudden, there was a warm feeling under my legs. Someone had put in a brazier full of coals from the fire under the table to keep us warm. And then from the table was coming goose dishes, because I was on the farm of Eduardo Souza, who is the man making the ethical foie gras in Extremadura. This guy is not stuffing the geese, force-feeding the geese. He's actually letting the geese roam, eating wild figs, wild lemons, wild grapes.
And then ripping out their livers to make...
Yeah, and then he's not ripping them out like hand puppets or anything like that. They've been sent off and dispatched in a humane manner.
Sorry, there are vegetarians across Melbourne who probably turned off after the horse discussion, so I don't think
we
can upset anybody.
We're free now. We're free to go. So I'm meeting him, and this man, you know, he's got this amazing product that's now... It's actually actually now coming to Australia. That's why I was there, because it's now available. It's in Sydney now, and Simon and Burrell, is that the Friend and Burrell? Friend and Burrell in Melbourne are now bringing it into Melbourne.
Good, because I need to get some to go with the truffles I bought not so again.
It is really costly because it's such a small production and because it's so artisan. But he said this is the culture I come from. Forever in this part of Spain, we've always had geese, and we've always cooked with it. And I wasn't so impressed with the duck liver, sorry, the goose liver, which is good if not great. It was the dishes to the side to make the use of the meat. There was one dish that was called alhadres, I think it's called, which is like a roti bread layered with goose fat and yeast, and it's stretched out, and then it's stuffed. Oh, in it is stuffed bechamel, enriched with sweetbreads, goose, middle-aged spices like nutmeg, cinnamon. And that is then rolled over and formed into a square, like a spring roll, shall we say?
Yeah, yeah.
And then cooked on the planche, on the hot plate, sprinkled with sesame seeds, and then cooked into a square, and then let cool. And it's, I would say, probably the most, one of the richest dishes I've ever had. Bechamel, sweetbreads, goose fat. Yeah, and but outside it's freezing cold, and they pour a glass of, and Eduardo and his wife poured a glass of one of the dreadful local wines. Yeah, there's a lot of this about
the things you have to say, Richard Cornish, seriously. Because we've only got a couple of minutes to go, I really wanted to... you said that joy of this is what I do now.
This is what I do now.
I've spent 6 months shaking my head going, this is what I do now.
I
run my own business. I work from home. Yeah. I get to go to lunches that someone's throwing on and they want, you know, some food people there. How extraordinary is it that you look at people who work Monday to Friday 9 to 5? Did they look miserable to you?
I don't know, because I actually work from home. And I made a point a long time ago to not drive to work and waste my time in the car. It took a long time I was very, very poor for a long time.
Yeah.
I've got a family to look after, and we've struggled. And it's only until now, like 10 years later, that we're actually, you know, starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel. Sacrifice, but there's a reward for it.
Mm. And it is a great reward. And then you end up, like, you know, doing these things on the Spanish Portuguese border and all of that. It must be a phenomenal experience.
We're very lucky. Frank Camora has just signed a contract with a book publisher to do a book in I think you're probably the first person to know about this before
John. Breaking news here on Craze.
Breaking news, yeah. He's just signed it in the last couple of days. We're off to Barcelona.
Barcelona.
For 4 weeks to do a book over there in Barcelona. So,
if you need somebody to come along, take notes, shorthand, I can do carrier bags, please.
Can you speak Spanish?
Un poco.
Beautiful accent.
Yeah, okay. Buenos días. I can do all of that. Now, we don't have very long to go. We've got about a minute. Give me your ultimate dining experience in Melbourne.
Ultimate dining experience in Melbourne. That's really difficult. the ultimate dining experience, it depends on the day of the week. It depends on where you are. I still like the bitter hot chocolate at Pellegrini's. I like going to Rose's and just sitting at the Rose's Cantina and just sitting at the table looking down De Graves Street. I do like going to Viedemond and just having a couple of little dishes there. Breakfast at Circa at the Prince on a Sunday morning. There's no one.
Mate, thank you for coming in and joining me today. It's been an absolute joy. We got nowhere with what you're doing, so you're going to have
to
come back.
I like that.
You are going to have to come back. This has been Cravings with me, Pete Dillon. I will be back next week with James Halliday, who is releasing the 2011 Wine Bible. But until then, eat well, drink well.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.